for about 15 plus years, and to see Erin just, you know, head over tail for Elizabeth is it was fun to watch as well. So it's good to see mush. We hope to see more mush around the church like that, and folks in love of God and love with one another. This morning we're in the fourth chapter of Numbers. If you would turn there with me, I want to introduce the message with a picture and a question. What's wrong with this picture? So let me read the passage behind it, and I'd like you to think in terms of what's wrong with this picture. 2 Samuel 6, verse 1. Again, David gathered together all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000. And David arose and went with all the people that were with him from Baal of Judah to bring up from thence the ark of God, whose name is called by the name of the Lord of hosts that dwelleth between the cherubims. They set the ark of God upon a new cart and brought it out of the house of Abinadab that was in Gibeah, and Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, drave the new cart. They brought it out of the house of Abinadab, which was at Gibeah, accompanying the ark of God. And Ahio went before the ark, and David and all the house of Israel played before the Lord on all manner of instruments, made of fir wood, even on harps and on psalteries, on timbrels, on cornets, and on cymbals. And when they came to Nachon's threshing floor, here's your picture, Uzzah put forth his hand to the ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen shook it. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and God smote him there for his error, and there he died by the ark of God. Wow. Why would God do that? Obviously, he is holy. He has the prerogative to do what he chooses. But why? What's wrong with this picture? Well, this chapter answers that question, and we'll look at it. We're going to find out through chapters 1 through 4 that to worship God properly is a serious matter. It's not to be done casually. In fact, if done inappropriately or improperly or unbiblically, it could lead to one's death. And so serving God in the tabernacle in the Old Testament could be dangerous business. I was thinking this week of dangerous jobs, and there are many. I did this little survey here looking at the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics for 2015, and they summarized what the 10 most dangerous jobs were as it led to fatalities. And so in that year, there were 4,836 fatal work injuries. Leading of that is logging or tree work. Many of you know my son owns a tree company. We pray for him nearly every day and his crew. Lord, protect those guys. We were with Jim this week for lunch, and he said, Dad, it's not if someone will die on the job. It's just a matter of time. It's really the issue of when. He walked down for that list. We have a fellow in the church has his own roofing company. Roofers, number 4. Even those who remove our garbage collectors, number 5. Some of you drive truck, dangerous job, number 7. I know growing up in Pennsylvania, Dutch country in Pennsylvania, it was every year, multiple deaths of farmers, or at least loss of arms or thumbs. And many a time you'd go out in the fields and throw the hay bales into the wagon, there was someone without an arm. And there's always a story of someone who died. And so the top 10 most dangerous occupations are by the U.S. Labor Bureau. I might challenge that. I think probably the most dangerous job is being a pastor. I was looking over my just 30 whatever some years of being a pastor and all my near-death experiences. And I looked at it, just kind of summarized my top 10 almost where I died things. And this is a dangerous line of work. I have taken guns off of helicopter machine gun operators. I've taken guns off of ladies who just shot their son, or tried to. I've met with angry people, drunk people, drug people, insane people, demon-possessed people. We almost lost all of us on the Chattooga River as we kayaked with our missionaries. We've done some serious climbs with friends in Israel. I thought could have died on Mount Arbel. They've now made it illegal to climb. It wasn't illegal when we did it. Mission trips, just traveling. If you go on foreign fields, people are crazy the way they drive. We had Maria, which we nicknamed Schumacher in Germany, on the Autobahn. Just insanity. Just 100-plus mile per hour all over the Autobahn. And dangerous. Scary. We had a Mercedes ride in Israel up those back alleys from Jerusalem to Mount of Olives. I thought we were going to die for sure. A head-on collision with a concrete wall, cement wall. I remember jogging on the back roads in Indonesia by a Muslim military installation base where they were training terrorists. I didn't know that until I got back to my room, and the the host of our group said, "Where were you this morning?" And I told him, he said, "No, don't tell me you're out there. That's a bad place. It's amazing you came back alive." Some of the food around the world can be dangerous. We've had outreach teams, you know, coaching outreach soccer can be dangerous with soccer moms and soccer dads. That can be really dangerous. Probably the most dangerous part of my job has been doing weddings. They can get really dangerous. Some of the blended family issues can be really dangerous. I think the most dangerous wedding I ever did was in South Carolina. It was a Cinderella wedding. The family was extremely rich, and I've sworn since then I'm not doing weddings for rich people ever again. She, the bride-to-be, came in a Cinderella, what do you call that? Carriage, thank you. Drawn by multiple, I'm assuming, were they white horses? White horses. And she came in from a mile or so out, and you could just see her working her way down to this outdoor wedding. And then there were the doves that were released, and the butterflies that were released, and the outdoor orchestra which played. It was the most complicated service I've ever seen. And as I was walking through the ceremony and going from one thing to another in this three-ring circus, I overlooked one song that was to be sung. It was in my notes. I just overlooked it. And the mother of the bride almost, I thought she was going to rip my throat out. And she's sitting right in front of where Big John's sitting. And I just happened to look at her, and there was smoke coming out her ears. And her neck was red. And she had darting eyes at me. If looks could kill, I was dead. And I realized, what did I do wrong? She hates my guts. And I'm trying to figure it out. And I realized, oh, there's a song. We're going to sing this song now, folks. And I saved it. But I looked at that lady, and I said to myself, I am never doing a Cinderella wedding again. Where they're expecting absolute perfection from everyone there. No thanks, it's not worth it. And I gave that wedding 5 years. That was a mistake. I think I made it 2 or 3, but I guess 5. But, and of course, you have a mother-in-law like that, good night. Woo-wee. That's a dangerous, dangerous thing. When we come to the Old Testament, Numbers chapters 1 through 4, this is dangerous work if you're a Levite. If you're working around this tabernacle, you know, there's a lot of things that really could go wrong. A lot of things that could go wrong. A lot of it was methodology. If you didn't follow God's prescribed way, it ended really bad for you. So here's a picture of the tabernacle there in the evening where you have the pillar of fire as a prominent focal point of it. We talked about this before, about how the tabernacle, when viewed from above, formed the formation of a cross. That's not by accident, that's by design. As we finish this first unit here in the book of Numbers, it indeed was a dangerous profession to work for God if you didn't want to do it right. Let me just summarize quickly. In chapters 1, 2, 3, and 4, each chapter begins with a command to Moses and Israel. At the end of chapters 1, 2, 3, and 4, the Israelites and Moses and Aaron obeyed. What a great start. So command to start the chapter, obedience to complete each of the four chapters. Right smack in the middle of those four chapters, there's a message that's to be gleaned. Notice what precedes it. Look with me in chapter 1, verse 51. Instructions were given. The phrase underlined in the stranger that comes nigh to the tabernacle, if he's a non-Levite priest, he shall be put to death. That's serious. Again, this is somewhat alluded to in chapter 1, verse 53. Same context, underlying phrase, that there be no wrath upon the congregation of the children of Israel. What that means is God's wrath would be vented if an unauthorized Jew or Gentile approached the tabernacle inappropriately. There would be death. God would vent his wrath. And then you have in chapters 3 and 4 additional warnings. In chapter 3, verse 10, it says again that the stranger that comes near should be put to death. Chapter 3, verse 38, and the stranger that comes nigh should be put to death. Here's what you have. Two warnings: if the stranger comes near, they're going to be put to death. And then again, repeated two times later. You say, what in the world's going on here? We get it. Well, right smack in the middle of those four warnings is the central phrase, central story of chapters 1 through 4. And it happens to illustrate the death of the priests, Nadab and Abihu, because they offered strange fire before the Lord. This is dangerous work. By the end of chapter 4, the warning is clear to everyone. If you are a non-authorized member of another tribe outside of the Levites, don't come near. You've been warned. If you're a priest, you've been warned by Nadab and Abihu's example. If you offer strange fire or worship not prescribed by Scripture, you've been warned. You will die. And then this chapter we're looking at this morning is really dealing with the dangers of being a Levite, to be the part of the support team to the priests and to the worship of God and to the congregation. And again, if you don't do it right, you die. Four different times it's referenced here. So this morning we're going to look at chapter 4. As you look at this diagram, we're especially looking at the blue box. What are the responsibilities of the Levites? The Levites were descendants of Aaron, or descendants of Levi. One of his sons, Aaron, will be the priestly line. So the Aaronic priesthood comes from the line of Levi. And then there's three other branches, the Kohathites, the Gershonites, and the Merarites. And so we're going to look at the Kohathites, the Gershonites, and Merarites, what their job descriptions are. That sounds rather boring, but in reality, it's really quite exciting. We'll get to it. So we're going to be looking at the workers of the tabernacle. If you're inside the tent, the courtyard, you are a priest. If you're working outside of that courtyard, you are a Levitical worker. So to the south, you're a Kohathite. To the west, you're a Gershonite. To the north, you're a Merarite. If you're Aaron or one of his sons, you camp to the east of the tabernacle and you work inside it. Inside the tabernacle, you have these seven pieces of furniture. Let's look at these. You have inside the Holy of Holies, which was a perfect cube, you have the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant. You come into the holy place, which is twice its length of the Holy of Holies, and you have the altar of incense and the table of showbread to the north, and to the south you have the menorah, the candlestick, the lampstick. Come outside the building and you have the bronze laver with water in it, and next to it you have the altar of bronze offerings. So you have these instruments forming basically a cross within the structure of the tabernacle. So we're going to be looking at the tabernacle and its workers this morning. So Moses says first, the Lord says first unto Moses and unto Aaron, saying, take the sum of the sons of Kohath from among the sons of Levi, after their families, by the house of their fathers, from 30 years old and upward, even until 50 years old, all that enter into the host to do the work in the tabernacle of the congregation. So here's what's going on. Just like we saw in chapters 1 and 2, a military census and where the tribes were to camp. In chapters 3 and 4, we now have a census for the workers of God and then their assignments as well. In this case, to do the heavy lifting, to do the mainstream work of the tabernacle, you had to be from the tribe of Levi, and you had to be somewhere between the age of 30 and 50 to serve. Now, that age will be lowered later in the book of Numbers to 25. And then David, when he becomes king, needs more workers and lowers it to age 20. But the key text here, 30 to 50. Now, with this census, the duties for each of these branches will be given. So we're going to look at in a moment the responsibilities of the Kohathites. And what I would like you to see this morning is some of these services that we're going to talk about aren't just some distant removed ideas that have no application to us during the church age. We will get to that. In a sense, we've had a little bit of an appetizer. We're getting into the meat now. I would say this is lima bean material, maybe broccoli material. You need it. You need it. Some of you love that, so it's a bad illustration. So pick the vegetable you don't like, cauliflower, whatever you don't like, asparagus, whatever it is. We're in that where you need this stuff, but it's not as exciting as the appetizer, nor is it as fun as the dessert. We'll get to the dessert at the end. The dessert at the end will be the applications and how this passage points to Christ. And so hopefully as we work through this section, there's still some meat. We went to a hamburger place last night and ordered it to go, went into the restaurant, waited, came out. And the bag felt light, just felt light. With everything I thought I needed to eat, it just seemed light. So I looked in it, one of the fries were missing. Not one fry, one bag of fries. So I went back in and said, you know, I'd like to, you know, I need the fries. You missed out on this. No problem. So they gave me the bag of fries and we went home. And so we open up our little bag, and there's the little French fries, but there's no meat. My burger was missing. I don't want you to leave this morning and say, you know what? We went there for a spiritual meal, and the burger's missing. I hope there's some meat in this. I think there is. So we're going to get to the duties of the Kohathites. Let's look at it. The Kohathites are going to serve under Aaron and his sons. So let's begin in verse 5. And when the camp sets forth, when God moves, he says, basically, you camp where I stay and stop, and when I lead forward with that pillar cloud or pillar of fire, you follow, you decamp, you package it all, and you follow, and then when I stop, you're going to reassemble the camp. This is going to happen 42 times in the book of Numbers, where they take down the camp, they journey, they set the camp up, they take down the camp, they journey, they set up the camp 42 times. So this is how it was to look. Aaron shall come and his sons, and they shall take down the covering veil and cover the ark of testimony with it, and shall put thereon the coverings of badger's skins, and shall spread over it a cloth wholly of blue, and shall put in the staves thereof. Okay, let's walk through what's going on here. Inside the building, the tabernacle building, you have two sections, holy place, holy of holies. In this diagram, you have a blue curtain in the middle of the building. So we're just peeling the top off. We're looking inside. So here's what's going on. God said, all right, Aaron and your sons, you are responsible for taking the furniture, the ark, the golden altar of incense, the table of showbread, the lampstand, the bronze laver, the bronze altar. You're to take all this furniture. It's your job to take it and package it and cover it properly and get it in a position where it's not visible to anyone else and where the Kohathites can come in and then take the furniture and get in the procession and go where God's going. So the way it works, the first and most important piece of furniture in this is the Ark of the Covenant. So if you look in the diagram to the left, you have this little table about yay big, covered with gold, has a seat on it, mercy seat, and inside of it you have two copies of the covenant. So don't envision four commands on one tablet and six commands on the other. Often that's kind of the way you look at it. Oh, there's two, you know, there's two commands, kind of two documents in there, and all Ten Commandments can't fit on one of them. That's wrong. You have Ten Commandments on one, you have Ten Commandments on the other. You have two copies. And you have two people involved in the covenant. You have God and man, Israel in this case. And so this ark was the first thing that they had to take down and package. And the way they began, they would take the curtain, that veil, that purple, that curtain in the middle, it has three dominant colors, blue, purple, and scarlet. It has three colors in it. And you have the pictures of cherubim woven in the fabric as well. So the first thing, you take that curtain down and you put it over the Ark of the Covenant. Secondly, we just read through this thing that they were to put something else on it. They were to put a badger's skin on it. Now, what in the world is a badger skin? Well, that's a tough word. We don't really know. It could be a form of a dolphin skin. A dugong or a certain particular dolphin there in the Mediterranean, but there were certain fish, dolphin-like animal critter in the Cava and in the Red Sea. Regardless, the layer we're describing here throughout the coverings, you can compare it to Gore-Tex. Gore-Tex. What is Gore-Tex? So in a couple of weeks, we're going to go up in the mountains and we're going to hunt, and I have a brand new Gore-Tex jacket. That's really good because that will repel. The water from Fatso Me. Okay, it's a very important layer I'm going to wear. So on this, you put on the veil, and you're going to put on a second covering, badger skin, as it's called here in the King James, which is your waterproof cover. You're going for a journey. Not that there's going to be a lot of rain in the desert, but to keep it from getting dirty or wet, you have this Gore-Tex layer. And then on the top of it, you have a blue cloth, pure blue. And that's going to be what's visible. And you're going to wrap, as an Aaronic priest, you're going to wrap that thing up and get it in good shape. And you're going to put the staves, those poles, through both sides of it. So you're going to do this number here. So you're going to wrap that thing up. You're going to put those staves for the rings on each side. And you're going to put the blue, those coverings, three coverings on it, with the blue on the outside. And then and only then, Can the Kohathites come in and pick it up by the staves, one guy on each corner, and carry it out and follow God? So that's what's being described here with the Ark of the Covenant. Now, it continues to say this in verses 7 and 8. When it comes to the next piece of equipment or furniture, the table of showbread, they were to do something with it too. As we walk through the furniture, we're walking from the Holy of Holies to the holy place to the courtyard. And you're going to see a diminishing value given to the pieces of furniture. All are valuable, but the preeminent piece is the Ark of the Covenant. The second most important piece of furniture, at least as it's given detail in this chapter, is the table of showbread. It's going to have two coverings. They shall spread a cloth of blue and put thereon the dishes and the spoons and the bowls, and covers to cover with all, and the continual bread shall be thereon, and they shall spread upon them a cloth of scarlet, and cover the same of a covering of badger skin, and shall put in the staves thereof. All right, so here you go. About a 3 foot by 1 foot and 1.5 foot long table. You've got six pancakes, 12 pancakes on the table, representing the 12 tribes of Israel. This is a table of the presence of God. And so here's how you were to do this. The Aaronic priest was to put blue covering over it first, and then to put over a scarlet cover, a second layer, and on the top, he was to put the Gore-Tex. So already there's a change. When you see the procession of these pieces being carried out, the Ark of the Covenant has the blue, and all the other pieces have the Gore-Tex as the outer covering. So if you're watching the Kohathites carry all the pieces of furniture, the one that stands out, it's the ark. It is in contrast to the other pieces of furniture. So you wrap this particular piece up. Let's go to the next piece. So here we have in verse 9 and 10, take a cloth of blue and cover the candlestick, the menorah, the lampstand of the lights, and all these different things. And then put this cloth of blue on it, and then badger skins. So watch what's happening. The ark has three colors given to it. The table has two colors. This next one only has one color. And then it has the Gore-Tex on the top. And that is the same as you're going to find with a golden altar of incense. Only one cloth, blue, with the Gore-Tex over it at the end. So here's your blue covering of the menorah. You start with the blue, and then you put the Gore-Tex over it. Look at verse 11. Same thing is described here with a golden altar. Spread a cloth of blue and cover it with the Gore-Tex. So you would do that number. Come to verse 13. In verse 13, what we have here is further instructions. Notice there's a transition from the Holy of Holies to the holy place and now to the furniture in the courtyard, which is only two pieces. The bronze altar and the laver. Laver's not mentioned, probably treated in the same way as the bronze altar. Verse 13, they shall take away the ashes from the altar and spread a purple cloth thereon. And they shall put upon it all the vessels thereof. And it talks about putting a cover of badger skin and put the staves in it. So what we basically have at this stage of Numbers chapter 4 is instructions to the priests, to Aaron and his sons. You go in, handle each of these pieces in this manner, and get the staves into that each of the pieces so they can be carried. And once and only once they're all covered, then the Kohathites are going to come in and they're going to pick up all the pieces by the staves, and they're going to march out and follow God. And the Ark of the Covenant will lead the way with a dominant, preeminent blue covering. So do you get the picture right now? So when I ask the question, what is wrong with this picture to start the message? We're going to get to the answer. You're starting to maybe put some pieces together. Why was Uzzah struck dead? It all comes back to Numbers chapter 4. All right. So the duties of the Kohathites are spelled out for us here. And then notice what verse 15 says. And when Aaron and his sons have made an end of covering the sanctuary and all the vessels of the sanctuary as the camp is to set forward, after that, after it's all packaged up properly, the sons of Kohath shall come to bear it. But they shall not touch any holy thing lest they die. Let's read it again. But they shall not touch any holy thing, any of the pieces of furniture, lest they die. These things are the burden of the sons of Kohath in the tabernacle of the congregation. So here's the instructions. If you're a Kohathite, if you see any of the furniture in the Holy of Holies and Holy Place, if you see them before they're covered, you die. If later when you're transporting these pieces, if you touch any of that pieces, you die. I think you're starting to get the message, what is wrong with the picture that we showed. Now, here's the difference. We're going to talk in a moment just briefly about the Gershonites and their jobs, and the Merarites and their jobs. They're going to be taking the rest of the tabernacle down. And they're going to be given oxen and carts to carry their parts of the tabernacle. So two of the three Levitical branches there, they're going to have carts and oxen to help them. That'll be spelled out later in Numbers. When it comes to the furniture, you don't put the furniture on a cart. They were to be carried by the Kohathites on their shoulders using the staves. Now, if there are other pieces outside of the furniture, they're going to get on the wagons, and the oxen will draw them. But when it comes to the Ark of the Covenant, you don't touch it, and you don't put it on a cart, and you don't modify how it's to be transported, you carry it. That's your burden as a Kohathite. All right, so here we come. Notice how many verses are dealing with the Kohathites. If you go through the chapter, 20 verses dealing with Kohathite responsibilities. And as you walk through the chapter, the responsibilities of the others are decreased in the number of verses and instruction. So you could say, wow, the Kohathites' responsibility after the Aaronic priests is really important. So it carries a lot of weight. Now watch what happens now. In this particular text, verse 16, Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, is to delegate certain jobs to the Kohathites and other Levitical priests, but there are certain things he was to do himself. So when it comes to management, we all have to make decisions. What do I keep for myself to do, and what do I delegate out to others to do? And so God makes it very clear, Eleazar, this is what you do. When it pertains to the oil of the light and sweet incense and the daily meal offering and the anointing oil, you carry that. Don't dish that off. You're responsible for it. This is your job, as well as the oversight of the other tasks. And then he goes on to say to Moses, that is the Lord, an important part of the chapter. The Lord spake unto Moses and unto Aaron, saying, cut ye not off the tribe of the families of the Kohathites among the Levites, but thus do unto them that they may live and not die. When they approach unto the most holy things, Aaron and his sons should go in and appoint them every one to his service and to his burden, but they shall not go in to see when the holy things are covered, lest they die. So I'm repeating myself on purpose. The priests were to package the furniture and cover them. Once they were done with that task, they get to blow the whistle, say to the Kohathites, we're ready for you. Come on in. And carry them out on the staves. So that's the responsibility here. Don't leave them vulnerable. Don't allow the curiosity to kill the Kohathite. Be very guarded. Get your job done. And then when it's ready, hand it off. All right. So that's the census and job description for the Kohathites. Then you have, in a much shorter form, the census of the Gershonites. And their responsibility is spelled out. Basically, the furniture's gone now. So their job is to take the curtains, the coverings, off of the tabernacle when they're going to do their journey. As you look at the tabernacle, there are four different layers of the curtains. The outer layer is what? It's the Gore-Tex. And under it is the other three different curtains or coverings. So now the Gershonites, they're going to take down that. They're going to take down the opening there in the front to the tabernacle building. And some other things are described in their job description. These are all delegated to them. They have very specific tasks spelled out here in the scriptures. And the Gershonites have a manager, a boss. It'll be Ithamar. So Ithamar, the son of Aaron the priest, is going to overlook their responsibilities. And then finally, we have the census of the sons of Merari. So again, men in that group, that breakdown of Levi, from age 30 to 50, They had different tasks to do. Their job, basically, furniture's gone, Kohathites, curtains and coverings, Gershonites, and now we have the Merarites. Basically, they pick up everything that's left behind. And that's going to include the 48 vertical boards. It's going to include the 60 posts around the outer courtyard and the ropes and the nails and, you know, spikes. And they're just going to clean the camp up. So they're going to take the last, whatever's left over, they're going to put in their wagons. And they're given 4 wagons and 8 oxen to do their job. Whereas the Gershonites only have 2 wagons and 4 oxen. So there's a little more heavy lifting here, a little more cleanup. So here's how it would work. God is stationed, is camped, and then he moves by this pillar of fire or pillar of cloud. God moves. The trumpets are sounded. We're moving forward. The priests get the work with the furniture. They get them all properly packaged. Then we have the Kohathites come in. Out they go with the staves. Then we have the Gershonites come in, take all the coverings off, all the materials off, and out they go following the Kohathites. And the Merarites say, okay, guys, whatever's left, just throw it in the back of the wagon. And out they go. Okay, so that's the message. So now, that was the lima beans. And hopefully you've enjoyed all the lima beans. You know, when I was growing up as a kid, you were forced. I was forced. Isn't that horrible? My parents would probably go to jail today. I was forced to eat anything on my plate. I think that's still a good thing as a parent. Kids, you're going to eat this. There's, you know, people dying all over the world. You get that spiel every time you don't eat, you know. And you need to eat what's on your plate. Well, I hated lima beans. And it was no surprise that our little Dalmatian always sat next to me at the table. So I was very clever watching parents, and the foods I didn't like always went to our Dalmatian. But that stupid dog didn't like lima beans. And that's a problem. That's a problem. Because you can sit there a long time. We're not going to be done. You're not leaving this table until every lima bean, you know. So you have to learn how to hide lima beans. This is things for the kids. You can do it in napkins, okay? If you have potatoes, you can do it in kind of the peels. I can teach you all the good tricks on how to hide lima beans. All right, so we're done with the lima beans. Census has been taken. All the numbers are given. There's 2,750 Kohathites that meet that job description, 2,630 Gershonites, and 3,200 Merarites, for a grand total of 8,580 workers to move the camp. Wow. I felt when we moved this summer, we had all the Levites working for us. I think we had 8,580 workers help us move this summer. I really appreciate it. That was awfully nice of you. Thank you again. Thank you again for honoring our 15th anniversary. I'm still waiting to write thank you notes. My wife and I, we've been behind. But thank you for your kindness in serving us. Well, the chapter ends, just like the first 3 chapters, with a statement that they obeyed what God had commanded them to do. That's great. So what you have in these first 4 chapters, command at the beginning, obedience seen at the end, command, obedience, command, obedience, command, obedience, and in the middle of the whole unit are 2 priests who didn't obey, and they died. And the rest of the book of Numbers is going to basically project that message. You trust and obey, you live and you'll be blessed. You disobey, you die. All right. So let's conclude this message. We have to say something practically now. So, as you've walked through these 49 verses, what practical point have you picked out that's going to change your life? And the answer to that question is probably nothing yet. Correct? Problem. So let's walk through the chapter. What are the lessons that we can learn from the past, from chapter 4, for life in the present? Just a couple thoughts. As we walk through these different verses, here are some points that come to me. The prime time for heavy lifting in ministry is probably between ages 30 and 50. I'm not saying I'm all washed up or anyone who's older than 50 is washed up and should be put out to pasture. I'm not saying that. But that's a prime time. You have health, hopefully. You have some experience. You have the energy to do it. It's prime time. I shared with our staff even this week or the week before that you guys are mostly in your 30 to 50 range. Pastor Larry and I and Brian were the only 3 pastors that are 50 or above. To the other guys, you're in your prime of ministry. Prime of ministry. To do heavy lifting. Number 2, I see here there's a premium placed on preparation for ministry. They didn't begin their public service as a Levite until age 30. Later in Numbers, it bumps back to 25. Probably there's a five-year apprenticeship, preparation regardless. Can you imagine just turning Levites loose without any instruction? Where they fail it, they die? You wouldn't do that to anyone. And today, you wouldn't want to turn young men loose into ministry without proper training because they'll ruin themselves and destroy some ministry. I've seen more young guys turn ministries upside down than I'd like to recount. They weren't ready. They weren't prepared. They hijacked things and they destroyed things. And people are, you know, sheep are scattered everywhere because of pastors who have too much pride and didn't get mature and didn't have the experience and training. I see a premium placed on preparation for ministry. Clear job descriptions. You know, what person here hasn't struggled with, I'm not sure if this is my job or not, or this person's doing my job. What are you doing my job? This is my job. You know, job descriptions. Where does my work begin and where does it end and where does yours begin and where does your end? That's good stuff. This is an organizational manual. This is a leadership manual. If you're a manager, go to Numbers chapter 1 through 4. There's at least 30 different principles for management in these chapters, one of which is to present clear job descriptions. Oh, boy, the care to protect things in a move. I told our guys, we have, and don't come into our house and steal it, please. We don't have a lot of valuables in our house, but this is very valuable. I'm guessing it's worth a little less than $1 million, okay? I know it's less than that. My grandmother Chips, who I adored, met a pastor. And the pastor fell in love with her. And she fell in love with him. The problem was she had been married before to two movie directors. She was a flapper. And the pastor was wanting to marry her, but his church said, if you marry her, you lose the ministry. You're not qualified. Fair enough. So he had to make a decision. Would his ministry become Chips, or would his ministry become no Chips in his present church? He chose the church. And in his send-off goodbye to her, gave her, this is the thing worth a little under $1 million, a 1935 Double B Hummel Madonna. What does that mean to you? How many Hummel collectors are there here? How many Hummel collectors? Few of you. When did Hummel begin? 1935. What is the most valuable Hummel? It's the double B Hummel. I know it's worth a little less than $1 million. Probably a lot less than $1 million. So I'm not tempting you. So when we moved, do you think I'm going to turn Jason Wilhelm loose with a bag carrying that double B Madonna? Okay? No, I'm not going to turn him loose. Or Ray Ray. Ray's got all this muscle. No way. I'm not turning that thing loose with Ray. We carried that over. You know, no one's going to. I'm going to carry that over. I value that. When you look at this thing, there are certain things God is saying, value this. Do you realize that furniture, ladies, listen to this very carefully, and guys, you'll love this point. This furniture would last Israel over 400 years because they took care of it. They moved all the time. So, men, here's the point for you. Honey, she wants the new furniture. You say, look, I think we need to just take care of what we have. Okay? See, guys, that's really helping you out this morning. Amen? My stepdad, you'll go out in his barns and garages and tool sheds. He has stuff he bought when he was in, like, second grade. He's a farmer, and he says, you take care of what you have. You work for it, you earn it, and you take care of it. Well, that's a good biblical concept. They took care of this furniture. They protected it in the move. As you walk through these chapters, they had an inventory on everything. Some of you do inventory at your manufacturing company or your whatever thing you're selling. Inventory is a good thing. Man, you got inventory going on all the time. I think we should take stock in inventory where we are spiritually. There's the importance of keeping things logically together. All these things that pertain to the lampstand, they kept together. All the stuff that worked for this table of showbread, they kept together. There was some thinking. There's an organizational process that they went through that's healthy. Again, if you wanted to get on the wrong side of my stepdad, just borrow one of his tools, and when he goes to find it, it's not there. You're dead. You are dead. And all those tools made sense. So all the wrench, all those doohickeys, those metric doohickeys. You know, you know what kind of mechanic I am. He scared the fire out of me. I never went in there. I was afraid he'd kill me. But there's order. There is design. You see that throughout the tabernacle. You have here Again, a lot of themes on the prioritizing of the care. Ark of the Covenant first. You have a prescribed way to transport furniture. Use those staves, guys. There's a way to do service. God is following the details. And sometimes that will lead to life, and if we don't follow the details, it can lead to your death. I can still see myself in Sears watching the Challenger. And that was so exciting to watch that flight. And then it erupted live right there. I watched it. Some of you did too. And you said, what happened? What went wrong? A little O-ring, a little detail that was overlooked. A little O-ring, and people are dead. Details, God is interested in them. Protecting others. All right, you Aaronites, safeguard the Kohathites. Protect them. Don't let them be cut off. Look out for others. Get their back. Protect one another. We're working together. Even though you have your job and I have my job, let's look out for each other. That's a big thing. Whether it's in the military or at school or on a team, to have one another's back, that's really important. And with Eleazar, he learned there were certain things he was to delegate and there were certain things he was to hold on to. Great principles. There's organizational oversight. That's a biblical principle. There's people that serve under and there's people that serve over. Both serve. They're servant leaders and servant followers. Curiosity can kill the Levite. Man, oh man, wouldn't you want to see the holy furniture? You're a Kohathite. You're right outside the tent. And you hear it from the priest. They talk. And you want to see the Ark of the Covenant? Wouldn't you want to see that? If you want to see it, it could lead into a really bad thing. Just go ahead and see it. And look into it, and you basically are vaporized. Really. All the curiosity can kill the Kohathite. Again, as I look through the whole of these chapters, organization is important. But the organism, which needs the organization, is even more important. Workers are more important. I see here God noting the workers and obviously not forgetting their labor of love. And as each chapter ends, I've already mentioned, it ends on complete obedience. So here's your chapters 1 through 4, and you have complete obedience. I see a lot of practical points in the chapter. Now let's end with dessert. How much of Christ do you see in this chapter? Chapters 3 and 4. How much of Jesus do you see? This is 1400 BC, before he was born. Did you see Jesus yet in the chapter? Do you see Jesus at all in the chapter? And he hints towards Christ. So let's just finalize. Let's finish our message. When I look at chapter 4 and 3, I see Christ everywhere. I see Christ everywhere. Chapter 3 last week, we saw the principle of the firstborn dedicated. What did that mean? Israel is a redeemed nation. They were miraculously delivered from Egypt by the power of God. They're redeemed. And God didn't want them to ever forget that they belonged to God and that he delivered them through power and grace. So to remember who they belong to, God said, I'm going to have the firstborn son be set apart to do work at the tabernacle and worship. And then we go through a little bit of Israel's history, and the Levites outshine the firstborn by a landslide when they defended the holiness of God at the apostasy of Exodus 32 when there was the golden calf incident. And so God says, I'm going to take the Levites, principle of the firstborn, and I'm going to substitute the Levites for the firstborn. Now, if you understand the context of the firstborn, this is what it is. The firstborn must be given to God saying, we belong to you. My family belongs to you. We all belong to you, all of our kids. But to acknowledge that publicly, I am going to set my side apart to serve at the tabernacle. That's what that's all about. And now the Levite is going to take the place of the firstborn. We have a principle of substitution being introduced. Well, how important are these principles? Well, Jesus is God's firstborn. He's the prototokos that the New Testament talks about. He's the one who's going to sacrifice himself unto God. He's going to be our substitute for a fallen mankind. He, the perfect man, perfect God, will die for mankind. So he fulfills a principle called substitution. Then there's the principle of redemption. We found out that there wasn't enough Levites to cover the number of the firstborn. It fell short, 273 people. So God says, for those 273, redeem them. Give 5 shekels of silver for each of those firstborn sons. Pay for them and give the money to the priest. There's a principle of redemption. And so although they're not all spelled out going to the cross yet in full detail, they're hinting there's going to be God's firstborn, Jesus, who's going to die for us. He's going to be our substitute. He's going to redeem us not with silver but with blood. The most repeated prophecy in the Old Testament deals with the typology of the tabernacle and the furniture. So in the Bible, 1 out of 4 verses are prophetic. And the largest topic on prophecy is the tabernacle and the furniture. It's repeated more than any other prophecy type. So the tabernacle pictures God dwelling with man. It speaks of Jesus. In John 1:14, and Jesus, the Word, became flesh and literally tabernacled with us. So the tabernacle is teaching us about Christ. The pieces of furniture are teaching us about Christ. The heavenly colors, blue, scarlet, purple, those are heavenly colors. The dominant color is blue. What comes to your mind? The skies, the heavens are blue, especially in our wonderful state of Colorado. Blue. So we're talking about heaven, and heaven we can say is a gigantic holy of holies. And so there are heavenly themes being broadcast through the whole chapter. And then the preeminence of the ark, the heavenly blue covering, pointing to the ark and to a covenant relationship. So incredible themes. When does a Levite begin his public service? At age 30. When did Jesus begin his public service as our high priest? Age 30. That's hinting towards another priest after the order of Melchizedek. It's speaking of a high priest, that the only way we can come to God is through Jesus, our high priest. And as I walk through this chapter, there's an incredible theme that's bouncing back and forth, is in the person of God, this union of immanence and transcendence. And what do I mean by that? And I'll finish with this thought. Everyone has a God. Even the atheist who says there is no God is claiming to be God himself. Everyone has a God. And your view of God will likely be one of 3 pictures. One is a transcendent God. If you're a Muslim, Allah is completely a transcendent high God, high and holy in their mind. Distant God. 99 attributes, names for Allah, none of which is love. Okay? Allah, distant God. Okay? That's called transcendent God. Immanence means drawing near, close, alongside of. So you have in the world transcendent gods. Gods are so distant you can't reach them. You can't connect with them. There's no heart-to-heart anything. They're just so far removed. And then in this world we have other gods that are immanent gods. The Norse gods, Thor, Woden, utterly imminent. They're just like us. They're men. They fight. They eat. They're lustful. They're adulterous. They're this and that. They're just like us. They're very imminent gods. And in most of the world, you have either this distant god out here you can't reach or get in connection with, or you have, this is my buddy, co-pilot, friend, this imminent, whatever you want to call that. When you come to the scriptures, what is the nature of God? He is the union of being transcendent and immanent at the same time. That's overwhelming to think about. He is the God who lives in a high and holy place, and yet by his in transcendence, yet he also dwells with him who is contrite and lowly in spirit. That's immanence, Isaiah 57. As you go through these chapters, you see God is holy. You better be warned. You disobey him. You cross over holiness. You sin. The wages of sin is death. There's a transcendent, mighty, holy God to be revered and feared. And yet God dwells in the midst of them in the tabernacle. That's an immanent God. He's both transcendent and immanent. There's some beautiful things describing the nature of God. Okay. Here's your question. You are tested now. What's wrong with this picture? There are 4 things wrong with this picture, and you know all 4 answers. And if you don't, I did a lousy job teaching you this morning. So I will take responsibility if you don't know what they are. Number 1, was Uzzah a Levite and of the branch of the Kohathites. If he was not a Levite and was not of the Kohathite branch, he had no right touching this thing. So you need to wrestle with that. Number one, was he a Levite and of the branch of the Kohathites? Number two, what's wrong with this picture? The ark is on a wagon. That's a no-no. All the furniture was to be carried over the on the shoulders with the use of the stays by the Kohathites. Now, the Gershonites and Merarites, they had their oxen, they had their carts with the other stuff. But when it comes to the ark and these holy instruments, these holy objects, that was a man's job to bear the burden. So it's on a new cart. That was awfully nice of you, David. But that was a bad decision. Bad decision. Your whole party is going to go south. This is going to rain on your party. So number two is being carried on a cart or a wagon by oxen when it was to be manually carried by the Kohathites. Number three, it was to be carried by those use of the staves. That relates to the cart point. But if you recall, number four, that the Kohathite was not to see the furniture before it was covered, and if the Kohathite touched the holy object, what would happen? You'd die. And so they're moving this procession along, and the oxen kind of do one of these deals, and here's Uzzah seeing the cart, and saying, oh my, we don't want to lose the Ark of the Covenant, someone's just get up there and steady it, and he touches it. Dead. Dead, just like that. That's what's wrong with this picture. And again, it should be all blue on the outside. That's an artist's rendition. It's wrong. It should look like this. So what's right with this picture? That's the way it should look. Four Kohathites using the golden staves, carrying the ark with a preeminent blue, a heavenly color. You know where that ark leads to in its typology? It leads right there. It leads right to the cross. Right to the cross. When you study the typology of the Ark of the Covenant, it goes right to the cross, and a new covenant is based on the shedding of Jesus' blood. And when Jesus died, the veil between the holy place and the Holy of Holies, it was torn from the top down. Why? What's the message? For the work of Jesus, Jesus is saying, and God is saying, you can come directly to God through the high priest Jesus. Folks, that's powerful to think about. And if you remember, on the ark, you would take that curtain veil, and that was what wrapped the ark. And now the message is leading the way to victory in Jesus. It's a very, very powerful message. There is Christ in the Old Testament. He is seen everywhere, of eyes to be seen. Do you know Christ as your Savior? And if you do, are you serving Him biblically and properly for the glory of God? Let's bow for prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you for this wonderful chapter in the Old Testament. Lord, you've written these things for our examples for us, for our admonition as well as our encouragement. We thank you for the new covenant based on the shedding of Jesus' blood on the cross. We thank you for a high priest who makes access to you, God, the Father, so that we can come through him to you. Lord, apart from coming through Jesus, we know that we are dead men walking. But if we come in faith to Jesus, there is life everlasting. Lord, if there's anyone here this morning who's never come to your Son in faith, where they've never repented of their sins and believed in the death, burial, and literal resurrection of your Son from the grave, I pray, Lord, that you would draw them to yourself through cords of love. May they see Christ and be wonderfully saved. May they look and live. Lord, thank you for this time that we have in your word this morning. For I pray in Jesus' name, amen. Let's stand.